I've just come to tell you how fabulous I am.
Wrong movie.
Right movie. Always the right movie.
What movie was that?
Shock Treatment.
Oh, oh. What's the TV remote? Can you throw that off signal on the television there?
Drinking another.
Jesus. What was this, number four for you?
No, it was already in there.
What do you mean it was already in there?
It was already in the shaker. That was
well, already
you
made.
But this is still your fourth drink.
Oh, yeah. It seemed like you were phrasing the question, did you make another? I'm like, no.
You're going to a party where there's going to be more alcohol.
Mm-hmm.
What do you do with yourself? When do you relax and not be around people? Like,
all right, I have the Wikipedia pulled up. You're fine with me just reading it full length?
Probably.
Would you like to take a look at it for yourself?
I mean, honestly, the thing is, like, there are so many minor details that pay off in some way in this movie.
True.
And it's, again, like, it's a 2-hour movie. I kind of expected it to be on the longer side.
Are you okay with me maybe disclaiming up at the front, this is going to be a long one?
No, I don't want you to say that.
I'm going
to
say it.
No, I want you to trick everyone, saying, like, guys, this is just 2 paragraphs long.
It's so short.
Like all the men in my life.
Oh, I'm a body old woman.
This is the podcast where three friends make a theme cocktail, watch a flawed movie, talk about what they like, what they didn't like, and then how they would fix it. I am Brendan.
Hey, your books are full of the, how do you say, the chocolate in American?
The fudge.
The fudge!
Drishler.
I'm Chris. Damn your Dickens. Ravel.
And I am Lee.
How about a, aperitif?
Jolly Rancher.
You almost pronounced it more right.
Yeah, you said it more aperitif.
Harder I.
Your brain wouldn't let you like be wrong. Like, no.
Your brain stopped coming and was like, but that's just not correct.
That's just too classy.
So perhaps you can infer this from some of our excellent accent work, but the movie we watched for this episode is 2017's Murder on the Orient Express, directed by and starring Kenneth Branagh, based on the Agatha Christie novel.
And starring...
Which I'm all sure you're all familiar with.
And starring
everyone.
A shitload of people
yeah,
that you
Denshi,
know.
Denshi, Fifey, Deppy, Ridley,
Colmany,
Odomy, Odomy Jr., Gaddy, all your faves.
I mean, a lot of people. I almost feel like we're going to waste too much time if we recite the cast
list.
Yeah,
we'll go into that later. To kick this off, the drink that we made to have while we watch this movie is called The Devil's Darlings, and it is made of, well, it was initially made like this, and then we kept molting. So let's start from the beginning. A very good place to start. It was 2 ounces of gin, 1/2 ounce of maraschino liqueur, 1/4 ounce of creme de cassis, and 3/4 ounce of lemon juice. And then you just throw it all together in a Boston shaker with some ice, strain it out, and slurp, slurp, slurp. What did you guys think of the initial round of
Well, okay, I think it's worth mentioning that the first gin that we used was a very unique gin.
Yes.
Which was an Earl Grey-infused gin, which I've been, frankly, struggling to work. Make work in a lot of drinks.
But here's the thing. On paper, I think an Earl Grey gin sounds fabulous.
Yeah, it's just that the way that this gin is on its own, it's like you get the gin bitterness, but also the black tea bitterness. And it's weird, and it needs a lot of sugar.
It needs a lot of sugar to counteract and to make it palatable, honestly.
Yeah, and so the first round we had was very harsh.
I'll say this.
To my taste.
It was harsher.
It was harsher? I still think it was drinkable.
It was good. I thought it was good, but I thought the, you kind of... For me, at least, like, I had to sort of, like, close the nose to drink it, because it had, like, a very alcohol-y, like, harsh sort of liquory smell.
Right. So the two thoughts that I had when I was drinking is, one, I wish it were a little more citrusy, and two, you can really taste that this is the gin that we used.
Yeah.
And it's interesting, too, because normally I love to get a little bit of that kick from the gin, that, like, piney, juniper-y kick.
Yeah.
Or cucumber, depending on what kind of gin you're using. But this one... It comes through in a way that you're like, ooh. Like, it's a little...
Yeah. No, it didn't come through, right? The second batch, we changed up a little bit two different ways. We added a tiny splash of Pimm's to put it in the glass.
It was coating the glass.
Yeah.
We changed up the gin for what is one of the more expensive gins available currently, with the Monkey 47 gin, which is from Germany.
Mm-hmm. And it's smooth as shit.
It's smooth as shit gin, and it changed the flavor of the drink entirely.
It did.
And it was fabulous.
Yeah.
And then, it was a lot better, I think, the second time. That.
Mm-hmm.
And then
Chris decided to strive for perfection.
Literally, the only thing I switched was I added in locally distilled Bully Boy whiskey. Not the white whiskey, the full, dark...
Yeah, regular whiskey.
Barrel whiskey. And it was just as fabulous. And I think what we discovered is this preparation of creme de cassis and lemon juice and Luxardo and just a splash of Pimm's is a great companion for many liquors, is what we're finding out.
It tasted great.
It really did. I think it was never bad, I think. I would agree that the first time was probably my least favorite of the three.
But it wasn't bad.
No, it was certainly good. Drinkable. Yeah, like, and it was good. I just think that we made it better.
I would say, amongst the things that we drank, this was one of the more, like, bar-ready things.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Like, you could drink this at a bar and feel like the bartender's done well.
Right. Yes. I think it's also nice because it was a very small amount of alcohol. So, it's not like, you know, it's not like you see this tumbler in front of you that you have to
Oh, God, yeah.
Also, am I wrong?
I don't think I could have done that.
Is this the first time we've taken these coupes for a spin for the podcast?
Yeah, I think so.
My fancy new coupes.
And these coupes are fabulous.
My Gatsby glasses, yep. as my family calls them.
I sure what calls them?
My family called them Jay Gatsby glasses.
I love that. Oh,
let's red light that down
the panties. That's so cute.
All right, so now that we've talked about the drink that we made, let's go on to the synopsis of the movie itself. Chris, you told me this is a very short synopsis.
Yeah.
And you would not be warning anyone of anything otherwise.
I'm definitely not warning anyone that this is a long one.
I'll just cut it out.
Okay, well, prepare to cut a lot then. In 1934, famous Belgian detective Hercule Poirot solves a theft at the Church of the Holy Sepulchre in Jerusalem. The obsessive-compulsive sleuth who seeks balance in life considers his case-solving ability to see a lie amidst the truth to be a curse, wants to rest in Istanbul, but must return to London for another case. His friend Book, nephew of the director of the Simplon Route Orient Express Service, arranges a bunk for him aboard the train. Unscrupulous businessman Edward Ratchet offers to hire Poirot as his bodyguard during the three-day journey, having received threatening letters from an unknown party, but Poirot refuses. That night, Poirot hears strange noises coming from Ratchet's compartment, and later sees someone in a red kimono running down the hallway. An avalanche derails the train's engine, stranding the passengers. The next morning, Poirot discovers Ratchet was murdered during the night, having been stabbed to death a dozen times. Poirot and Book investigate the other passengers as repairs begin. Evidence indicates that Ratchet was murdered by one person, and Caroline Hubbard, a fellow passenger, claims that a man had been in her compartment in the night. Poirot discovers a partially burned note connecting Ratchet to the kidnapping of Daisy Armstrong, a child who was abducted from her bedroom and held for ransom. Ratchet's true identity is exposed. He was John Cassetti, Daisy's kidnapper and murderer. Although her family paid the ransom, Daisy was murdered anyway. Her death so profoundly shocked her mother, Sonia, that she gave birth prematurely to a stillborn baby and subsequently died herself. Daisy's father, Colonel John Armstrong, then committed suicide. Suzanne, the family's nursemaid, was wrongly suspected of complicity, arrested, and subsequently committed suicide in police custody, only later to be found innocent. More evidence is found, including Cassetti's coffee cup laced with barbitol, an embroidered handkerchief, and, in Mrs. Hubbard's compartment, the button of a conductor's uniform. The uniform is later found, as is the red kimono, in Poirot's own suitcase. Hubbard is suddenly stabbed in the back. She survives, but cannot identify the culprit. Poirot discovers many of the passengers have direct connections to the Armstrong family and uncovers their hidden pasts. While interviewing governess Mary Debenham, Poirot is shot in the shoulder by her fiancé, Dr. John Arbuthnot, who claims responsibility for the murder, but Book stops him from killing Poirot. Poirot realizes that Arbuthnot never meant to kill him. A decorated army sniper and medical doctor could not have missed making a fatal shot at close range. Poirot confronts the suspects outside the train, offering two theories of how Cassetti died. The first is simple but does not meet all of the facts. A murderer disguised as a conductor boarded the train at a previous stop, murdered Cassetti, and fled the stop as the train left. The second is more complex, with every single suspect connected in some way to the Armstrongs, Suzanne or her trial, they all had a motive against Cassetti. Poirot predicts that they acted together. Hubbard is revealed to be Linda Arden, a former stage actress and inspiring director, who is Sonia Armstrong and passenger Helena Andrenyi's mother, Debenham to be Daisy's former governess, Arbuthnot to be an old friend of Daisy's father, Pilar Estravardos was Daisy's nurse, Benjamino Marquez was the Armstrong's chauffeur, elderly Princess Natalia Dragomirov, a close friend of Linda's, was Daisy's godmother, Hector McQueen being both Ratchet's assistant and the son of Suzanne's prosecutor, E.H. Masterman's both Ratchet's majordomo, and, as he himself declares, a member of Colonel Armstrong's war troop in World War I. Fraulein Hildegard Schmidt was the Armstrong's family cook. Helena's husband was Count Rudolf Andrenyes, was Sonia Armstrong's brother-in-law, and Gerhard Hardman was the police officer in charge of the Armstrong case who fell in love with Suzanne. That's way too fucking complicated. Hubbard confirms the latter, admitting that she planned the murder and had recruited everyone else to help her. All other passengers and the conductor, Pierre Michel, Suzanne's brother, took turns stabbing Cassetti so none of them would know who struck the deadly blow. Mary wore the kimono. Arbuthnot stabbed Hubbard at her direction without endangering her life to convince Poirot of a lone killer. Poirot challenges the passengers and Michel to shoot him with a confiscated gun, since he is the only one who can expose their plot. Bouc can lie, but Poirot, obsessed with the truth and balance, cannot. Hubbard grabs the gun and attempts suicide, but it is not loaded. Poirot wanted to see how the suspects would react, and Hubbard's reaction confirms that they are not killers at heart. With the train back on track, Poirot concludes that justice is impossible in this case, as Cassetti deserved death. For the first time, Poirot will have to live with a lie and an imbalance. He presents the lone killer theory to the Yugoslavian police, allowing the others to leave on the train. As he disembarks, a British army messenger asks him to investigate a death on the Nile.
What's that?
Poirot accepts the case. The collective culprits led by Hubbard all go free. And that is Murder on the Orient Express 2017.
Thank you, Christopher.
Mm-hmm. I just have to say, this entire thing was a fucking mouthful.
Yes.
I mean, it's a mystery.
Like so many grapes.
Like so many cotton candy grapes.
That's your German accent, I see. So anyways, so what is everyone's familiarity with Murder on the Orient Express in general, be it the movie or the book or the previous adaptation?
None,
okay.
I mean, I think that I said earlier that, like, I feel like I've known subconsciously with my knowledge of and, like, love of other mysteries and detectives in general that, like, there was some sort of crime set, like, famous murder scenario contrivance where, like, everyone did it.
Mm-hmm.
And so, like, I remember not being surprised at the end because I was like, oh, this is a familiar trope to me. Like, I guess I was familiar with the trope of, like, everyone did it. But I didn't know it was this book or this detective, and I've never seen a Hercule Poirot mystery before.
Okay.
It's likely this was, if not the originator, maybe a popularizer of the everyone did it trope, which is what I think actually ultimately subtracts from the shock of this. But I have quite a bit of familiarity with it. My dad has a habit of kind of going hard into one kind of movie or movie series. He did it with Planet of the Apes, and he did it with Hercule Poirot adaptations. So I saw a few of Murder on the Orient Express and Death on the Nile both, as well as I think a handful of other minor Poirot mysteries. However, that was many years ago. So while I found it all to be very familiar, I did not recall everything beat by beat, aside from the everyone did it resolution.
So I myself likely had no real familiarity with this. I did not know that this was the ending to the movie or to the book, that everyone actually did it.
Mm-hmm.
I went to see this in theaters in 2017, back when it came out. And at the time, I remember by the time we got to the end, I was very frustrated. I didn't think this was a bad movie. And we should establish that this is not like a train wreck of a movie.
No, not at all.
It's not as if some sort of metaphorical avalanche fell down upon this movie, keeping it trapped over a precipice for several days. I digress. As I said, when I got to the end of the movie, the way it was presented for me in this version of the movie is that Poirot had explored every other option, and at a certain point, he just throws his hands up in the air and says, like, I guess it must have been all of you who did this. And they're like, yeah, you got us. It really was. Because I don't think this movie did a very great job of explaining to me what led him to that conclusion. So having said that, we've all talked about our familiarity with it. I guess we should just sort of go into the movie itself at this point.
Mm-hmm. So where do you want to start, Bren?
The first thing I'd like to go through real quick is the suspect list.
Ooh.
So this will allow us to talk a little bit about the characters in the movie, the actors who portrayed them, how they did, that sort of thing.
Yep. I just want to note for any listeners at home, we're getting into talking about the actors way earlier than we normally do on this podcast. But because...
check it off on your bingo card, everyone.
But because the cast is so large, I don't see another way around this.
That's right. Going into this, we should start with the non-suspects so you can say anything you want to say about them. But Kenneth Branagh is playing Hercule Poirot.
I think he does a great job.
It's very different interpretation of Poirot.
Yeah,
and
so that's a thing to, like, mention, is that in the books, Poirot is sort of like an eccentric kind of, like, jolly, I guess you would describe him.
In my head, I think it's honestly easy to confuse him with how you might think of Horace Slughorn from Harry Potter.
But he's like, Lee, that means nothing to Lee.
No, but he's like, he's like rotund. Well, he has I'm not even saying that.
Physically,
he's walrus-like.
Right. Well, physically, of course, Kenneth Branagh is a lot more
to
in
me,
shape.
Chris Poirot, like Slughorn is Poirot. Like I've never read a Poirot, but I'm very familiar with the persona of like he's a jolly Belgian guy.
Yeah. And I don't think Slughorn, like you're going physically here because personality-wise, okay.
Yeah.
Anyway, I digress. He's kind of sort of like an eccentric, effete dandy almost. I think in the books where he's sort of goofy and silly, and sometimes that will cause people to underestimate his abilities.
When he sleeps, he wears a mustache maintainer.
But in the in the books, he's sort of like a Epicurean.
He knows like what's good in life, and he enjoys that.
He's like a classy hedonist.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. That's so, what like, I think of when I think of Kenneth Branagh too.
He's not like. Whereas Murder by Death, I think, plays up like he's just like this
just like
fat guy that eats all the time.
Yeah.
He's just a, sort of like a chef that enjoys his profession.
He's a gourmand who can solve mysteries.
Exactly, yeah.
So on the other hand, though, you have Kenneth Branagh in the movie, and Kenneth Branagh is a very handsome, like, is he 60 by this point?
At least.
Okay.
Yeah.
He's a very handsome looking man. He's in very good shape. He's clearly a lot more physically active than Poirot would be in the books.
Yes. I think to varying degrees of success, I actually found it to be unnecessary to insert such action scenes in this.
I would say every instance of it is not something that works for me.
Well, and I feel like it starts to expose some of the movie's seams where they're like, it feels like they're bending the story to be like, but how can we have Kenneth Branagh like... show us he's still got, like, fitness.
I think it's more like, what will keep the audience from falling asleep?
Correct.
Americans are going to sit there and saying, like, oh, more people talking. Boring. Why can't we have Josh Gad run down some scaffolding instead?
I don't think that Branagh is that egotistical that he's like, I want to show off that I can still do action scenes. I think it was that he was worried about doing like, a movie where it's just people talking on a train for 2 hours.
I think you're right.
Yeah.
But, I mean, on face value, I have, as someone that's not really that into Poirot and didn't chose not to read him for those reasons, of knowing the kind of character that I was going to be getting into, I have no issues with Branagh's divergence from canon there. Like, I'm fine with him being a more somber version of this. Because, like, I read Sherlock Holmes. I didn't read sort of whimsical British people and Belgian people, like, that have family relatives good food.
You're not used to the master detective in a very Sherlock Holmesian situation to be so flamboyant, perhaps.
Yeah, I prefer my detectives a bit stoic and angsty and somber. I don't really prefer them to be... I mean, I guess I enjoy Psych too, but like, I like Branagh's decision to make him sort of like more serious. And
world weary?
Yeah, and I don't think that in either case of the book or the show or this particular interpretation that his physical appearance really need matter.
Yeah.
I don't think it matters. I think he can, as we saw in the movie, he still did enjoy his, like...
eggs.
Special breakfast and, like, his... like, he still clearly was an Epicurean.
Yeah.
He had a fine taste for things. That fucking dessert that he had, the jet de tasse.
Yeah,
The fragilité. Can we talk about the introduction to his character?
Well, I want to talk about that later.
Okay. Yeah.
So, because we were just talking about the actors now here. So,
Kenneth Branagh, do we agree he did a great job?
Yes and no.
I think we have different opinions on it, but I prefer my detectives to be a bit more like Branagh is in this movie.
I think that it's fine if he's a little more of a serious character than he is in the book, because in the book it seems like that's just not an aspect of his personality whatsoever. And I think that's probably just indicative of like the times and what Agatha Christie wanted to write as well. Like,
she was generally more lighthearted.
She wasn't really interested in that sort of thing.
She did more kind of like cozy chamber mysteries as opposed to like... character-driven, like, dramas.
And so, at points, it made him too sad sacky. Like, he wasn't very fun for me.
Well, give us the fun in the first installment. I'll take sad sack in the second installment.
Okay, this is another thing you're talking about that we'll have to get into also.
Yeah.
But, I understand what he was going for. I didn't love it, I think, though.
Yeah, I will agree that it's a little weird to ostensibly meet this detective as a sort of, like, already fatigued...
Right, well, it's like, like how when Batman shows up in Batman v Superman, he's already, like, done with the job. He's, like, so over being Batman at this point. It's like, are you?
Also,
we didn't see you do it.
But at the same time,
Batman,
I think this is the problem of both Batman v Superman and this, is that...
A connection I did not see coming.
No, they are similar in many ways. I get it.
Shut up. It's a real similarity.
Which of my rogues gallery killed Commissioner Gordon? It was all of you.
This is a real similarity. They are both in the zeitgeist in different ways.
That's true. Very much.
It doesn't, like, for me, I wasn't approaching this as, like, this is the first mystery he's ever done. Because it's not, it's yes, it's like the first Branagh one, but it's not the first, I know going into this movie that this is not the first case Poirot
No, I know, but it's just, it puts him at such an interesting point in his career that you want to see what it was like before then.
Again, I think it makes more sense to know that I didn't know going into this that he wanted to make it, Branagh wanted to make more of these. If this was just like, I want to do
a
Poirot, I get that, like, I want to do it as, like, I want to do the movie of his swan song.
So, now that we've talked about, I think, Poirot pretty considerably, let's just real quickly, Bouc, who is his, sort of, his friend, he is the nephew of the owner of the Orient Express, and he is more of, he's like a happy-go-lucky, carefree guy.
He's a man about town.
He's an innocent scamp.
He's introduced to the audience with a prostitute on his arm, so, like...
You know what you're getting in there.
He's handsome, he's charming, he does seem to have his heart in the right place, where he does want to solve this mystery. He kind
mostly
of serves...
for his Ben's business.
But he does tend to be a decent sounding board for Poirot, because he tends to be like, well, I think it's this, and Poirot is the one to be like, well, I can see how you would think that, but I actually think there's a deeper thing going on here.
It's a fine choice for, like, someone that is there to be a sounding board.
It's interesting, because in the book, he's a much older character. He's, like, closer in age to Poirot. So it's interesting that, like, they were like, okay, but let's get some hunk in here so Kenneth Branagh could talk to him for a while, too.
Yeah.
And it's an interesting sort of, like, character difference also, I think. Just, like, the fact that one is someone who Poirot has presumably known for a very long time, whereas this guy is, like, in his late 20s or early 30s, probably.
Yeah.
And so it's different. I'm not saying it's bad, just like it's an interesting choice.
I think it's part of the whole enhancing the feeling of him being a tired old man.
Yeah.
Like that this is sort of like someone that knows him, but like it shows that there's you see that difference in perspective of their opinions.
Yeah.
If we're good on Bouc, I would love to talk about Michelle Pfeiffer in this movie.
Okay, well I have a list on my phone so we can hit them all up.
Sure. Are we good with doing Michelle Pfeiffer now, though?
Well, I'm trying... Is there anyone else who's innocent who really matters? Like, who is not one of the suspects? I don't think so. Okay. So our first suspect we have is Mary Debenham, who is played by Daisy Ridley. She is a governess in a secret relationship with Arbuthnot, and she was also the governess for baby Daisy Armstrong, the one who was killed.
I think Daisy Ridley does good work in the role. At the end of the day, at least in my opinion, it's somewhat of a red herring. Because the way the movie is shot and the emphasis it places on Mary as a character seems to be leading in the direction that she has more of a mastermind position than she really does by the end of it. Because she's sort of like Michelle Pfeiffer Jr. in this way, where she seems to be more of a power player when that position is really Michelle Pfeiffer's.
I don't know if I would... I mean, I guess she's red herring-y in the sense that we don't know what anyone's job in this thing was until the end of the movie. So any one of them should be, you know, capable of masterminding some sort of attempt on guy's life. I don't think that... I watched this movie and was like, oh, this is secretly the one who's in charge. And then at the end, I was like, but a governess? So I don't know if I felt quite the same as you do about that.
She gets multiple meetings with Poirot where everyone else gets their one meeting where they spill their story and that's it. And I think there's something notable.
Michelle Pfeiffer
about that.
Shows up a few times.
But that does pay off because she is the one who.
Right, yeah, and I'm sure so does Josh Gad.
Mm-hmm.
Arbuthnot.
He gets like two. Arbuthnot gets one and a half.
And Daisy Ridley gets like two. I don't think. I mean, maybe you're thinking of it because she's introduced before the other.
Yeah, I don't know.
I don't know.
I guess I just felt like we were led to believe her character held more importance than the rest when I don't think
you
it
made
does.
Her and the Doctor. Significantly earlier.
Right, and so, like, perhaps that's what you're getting it from, but I don't...
Maybe.
I don't know.
I think she does a good job.
I think Daisy Ridley's generally fine in this role.
Yeah. I think she looks great in the period styling. I think she does a good job.
I'm going to say at the top of this that I don't think anyone did bad.
No,
me neither.
I don't really think so. I think, as we will say, I'm sure some people have less of an opportunity to make an impact in their roles, but I do think everyone does their part well.
Yeah.
Next, we have Dr. Arbuthnot, played by Leslie Odom Jr., who is a doctor who was put through medical school by Colonel Armstrong. This character, Dr. Arbuthnot, is a composite character of Colonel Arbuthnot, who is a character in the books. He was a friend of Colonel Armstrong. And Dr. Constantine, who is an older man who was in a different train car, and so he couldn't be a suspect when Cassetti / Ratchet was killed. And his role is basically to do kind of what Bouc does, where he just, like, goes to investigations with him and, like, every now and then will throw in his two cents and acts as a sounding board.
I think Arbuthnot's an interesting character. I think Leslie Odom Jr. does a good job with the character. I think that's one of the situations where they do make the choice in casting Leslie Odom Jr. mean something in the story. Because they do note, wow, like, what this character must have gone through to be a doctor and a black man, and the fact that he's in this situation. I'm glad they put some mileage on that.
And they also say one of the things that causes Poirot to want to solve this case is Book says to him, like, if you don't solve this, the police are going to come here and solve this. And chances are they're going to say it was Leslie Odom Jr. or the Cuban-American guy, like, mm-hmm. because of the fact that they are not white people.
On a note, though, I got to wonder about that, because it's true that race isn't a factor then, but also at that era in Europe, nationalization would also be a huge factor. Mm-hmm. There were a lot of, like, Caucasian ethnic subgroups that would also be similarly viewed as, like,
right. Although suspicious. I'm trying to think, like, were there any on there? I mean,
probably not. Jewish, but, like,
people. I mean, yeah. Jewish people were, so, like, would Dragomirov be seen as potentially
I don't know,
problem?
Because she's, I don't know, wouldn't Russian still be kind of okay at the time?
I don't know, honestly. Would it?
I don't know.
I mean, I think that you're still probably always, you're never wrong with saying that browner skinned people are going to be viewed first.
Yep.
But also, like, you know, religion was a huge thing.
Right.
Yeah.
Being Irish was still big.
No, but also, like, Catholic versus that. Protestant, yeah. that kind of
yeah,
thing.
Yeah, there were a lot of... We were a lot finer in the way that we discriminated back then. We really like
these white people.
Yeah, we were distilled it down.
Gonna use it as a transition to the next character on my list, who is Bienvenido Marquez, played by Manuel Garcia mm-hmm. Rulfo. He's a car salesman who was the Armstrong chauffeur. In the books, he is an Italian. He's named Antonio Foscarelli, but is more or less the same character. But they do mention in the books, apparently, how, like, Italian people love to use knives.
Yeah, it was so weird. But,
okay.
It's
sort of like they're like they come just short of being like, I think he's a member of the Black Hand.
Well,
or
I mean,
something.
No, I mean, it's, I think it's literally just that, like, as we had said, this was like the sort of racism the people were, and those saying, like, oh, like, this is why we hate Italians.
Yeah, Italians are passionate people.
Yes.
They're going to stab someone.
Yes,
they're
very
stabby.
It sort of makes sense then to take that and make a direct comparison to today and make him a Cuban American instead of, you know, an Italian. Which I think, like, again, if you're looking for a character to cast in it, but with a non-white actor, that one would probably jump out as you mm-hmm. as an easy swap to make.
Yeah.
Also, I mean, on an extremely shallow level, he's sort of one of the few stud muffins we get in this movie. He's a good-looking guy.
I don't think he's one of the few.
I mean, yeah, you get Book.
Yeah,
you get Braddock if you want to go that way.
You get Leslie Odom Jr.
That's
I'm
right.
I'm way more into Defoe.
Yeah, I know. Lee gets Willem Dafoe, and you also get the...
Willem Dafoe is a slice in this
everyone,
movie.
And
okay?
we also get the Count. So, like,
yeah.
it's full of attractive... Whether or not you find them attractive, it's clearly full of attractive young
you
men.
You want to fuck the Count if you want to fuck Patrick Bateman. Like, where he looks, like, so clean-cut but murderous.
Anyways, so...
But I want to say one thing about
Marquez.
That character is that, I don't know... I don't know if this was just me. That accent was so proper. Like, I could not pin
it
down.
No,
it
was
no.
a strange accent.
I don't know what he was trying to accomplish. I think he was clearly trying to accomplish, like, a bit in America for a long
yeah.
time.
Yeah, I think he was trying to, like, play up how American he was.
Yes.
Might be
yeah.
Like, I talk like the superest American boy.
I think the actor actually had a very complicated task where he had to speak with a Cuban bordering on American accent. An
yeah.
Americanized Cuban sort of identity.
Yeah,
and honestly,
from Mexico.
If someone came to me and been like, you're this, but you're becoming American, play that accent, I would have been like,
yeah.
I don't know. So kudos
that's
to that.
That's why Braddock didn't cast you, Chris.
I
that's
know.
Why he wasn't
I was,
responding
I was
to your calls.
I was fucking up for that Cuban role, but I didn't get it.
Michelle Pfeiffer and you at the end.
Oh my God. You know... If I was anywhere close to that, I would have sunk my teeth into that audition.
Pilar Estravado is played by Penelope Cruz, who is a pious missionary who was Daisy's nurse. In the book, she is Swedish, and her name is Greta Olsen. But same basic character.
I think you bend some of the rules to get Penelope Cruz. You want another name on this kind of cast of Hollywood royalty.
And again,
to
you
this.
Probably maybe want to go for someone who's not white.
Yeah.
Like, just to spice
it up. Just to spice it up. I mean, you know, nothing from casting Penelope Cruz and saying the word spice, but, like, I think she does a good job.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Next up we have, I mean, sometimes there's nothing to say, like, they are
there's
fine.
People,
yeah.
I mean, these are like, who's gonna be in this room? Who among us will tell us who's gonna say that Judy Dench is a bad actor?
Yeah.
Who's gonna be that bold?
Not me.
Who's gonna make that hot a take?
I mean, so where are we going? Where are we going next?
So from there I have Hector McQueen played by Josh Gad. He's the assistant to Ratchet.
I just
Thank
thought
you.
Of...
He's the assistant to Ratchet and the son of the DA who is pressured into prosecuting an innocent maid in the kidnapping of Daisy and was disgraced by his actions.
I think Josh Gad does great.
He's fine, yeah.
Yeah.
It's not a typical Josh Gad role.
No, it's not. It's not very
it's not
bumbling
hammy.
Or funny.
It's not
yeah,
hammy at all.
Yeah, he doesn't get to be like a comic.
Yeah.
You know.
Or he's not even like pathetic or put upon, really.
Yeah.
Which
you know
is sort of what I might have expected from
what
Hector
I was going to say
yeah.
is we're going to have to get this to the end of your list, but
yeah.
when we... One really obvious thing that we, like, anyone before we go through the suspects, we did not talk about the victim.
Yes.
We'll talk about that
Please,
at the end.
Please, I'll add a note real quick here at the end.
We gotta talk about the victim.
The Vicky.
Yeah.
I also think, just this is so minor, but Josh Gad pulled off that mustache really well. I thought he looked great.
Yeah. I think it helps make him not look so...
clownish.
Comedy side character.
Yeah, like the goofy sidekick.
For sure.
He looks, I don't know, like... the fashion of this movie works pretty well for a lot of them, I have to say. Like, these people 100%. Wear their costumes well. Okay, so after him, we have Masterman, played by Derek Jacobi. He's the butler to Ratchet and was Colonel Armstrong's Batman during World War One and later their family butler.
Listen, Derek Jacobi does great work, period.
I'm not gonna, I'm not gonna be the one to tell you that Derek Jacobi is his alternate dimension twin. That is gonna write some sort of hot take article about him. He's a storied actor. I'm not here to tell you that he just didn't do good in this movie.
I guess minor thing of note, the only difference I can think of is that in the book his character is not dying of cancer.
That's a weird detail.
It is a weird detail because it doesn't do anything. Right, no, I feel like it answers a question that need not have been asked in the first place. Yeah. Because like he only says that because he's flashing back and he tells Johnny Depp, like, oh, like if I were to leave you something on your pillow, it wouldn't be an angry note. And Poirot's like, oh, like why are you being so mean to your boss? And he's like, I'm dying of cancer, so I'll say what I want to say. But it's just like, again, you could have had him not be like a snide bitch whenever Johnny Depp asks, like, would you leave something on your pillow? And just have him be like, no, sir. And then like you don't need to explain it.
The only thing it does is that it goes some distance to explain why this character would think nothing of killing Johnny Depp. Sure, I'm dying, I've got nothing to lose.
Yeah, I guess it gives him a little bit of a motive in that sense. Yeah. That's true. So Count Rudolf Andrényi, played by Sergei Polonin. Wow, what a bitch you are. A Hungarian count, and he is the uncle to Daisy by marriage.
He doesn't have a lot. He doesn't have anything to do. His job is just a scowl.
He scowls well. His introduction
is insane.
Where like a guy just goes up to him and is like, hey, can I get a picture with you? And his friend takes a picture.
Everyone.
And he starts fucking punching everybody.
Well, and then he also does... And I guess this is supposed to be a nod to his like career as a ballet dancer, but he does this like very balletic roundhouse kick on.
He does
someone.
A lot of like he's like body acting a lot in this movie.
He is. He's very graceful. Yeah. Which
I wonder if he's a dancer.
He is.
Right now. He is.
He's a ballet dancer.
Yeah. Wait, but that makes sense. The actor.
Yeah.
The actor is.
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
In real life, he's a ballet dancer.
And that's Dan Sturry's.
Yeah. That carries. Yeah.
He didn't come to act. He came to.
Yeah. I came to dance. So next up on that note is Countess Elena Andrényi, played by Lucy Boynton. She is a countess by marriage to Rudolph. Her actual name is Helena Goldenberg. She's Daisy's aunt, and she is addicted to barbitol as a result of the murder.
She puts a lot of acting into
the barbitol.
A little screen time.
She might have the most condensed acting of anyone in this movie.
I agree with that, because she really only gets that one scene.
She appears silent in one scene, and then she has like a total fucking nutcase.
And I think almost every other scene is just like her curled up with her husband, like sort of vaguely looking at the camera. While he holds her.
I actually have the largest issue with her character. Not that I have a problem with... Yes, of course. Given the trauma you have, you're turning to barbitol, you're getting fucked up all the time. I don't have an issue with that. But in terms of how the movie frames her character, it's very confusing. Because the way that she's introduced immediately after her husband is she sort of slinks in... And it's framed as if she's more like a femme fatale character. But then in function and how you see her later... She's, like, helpless and drugged up for most of the time.
See, so that... I get what you're saying, but I also feel like it doesn't necessarily read that way, where she just sort of comes in and, like, touches him. And I think it depends upon, like, how... Are you reading that as her calming him or him calming her?
Well, yes, but the way that it's framed, it's a lot more confidently in the beginning than when you see her later.
No,
and it's hard for me to believe that that wasn't conscious, because it is so different. She is so vulnerable and slurry and fucked up on barbitol when you see her next. That's very different from the kind of, like, confident presentation we get.
I think that, as she says in that scene where she's totally coked out, is that... She, like, doesn't need it during the day as much. She's, like, probably having, like, a hangover during the day.
Yeah.
And at night is when she's doped up on it.
Because she needs to sleep or something. Isn't that what it is?
Using it to calm her or help her.
Yeah, I think night is probably when she freaks out, and so she needs it to calm down at night. Something during the day, she probably is just, like, a strung-out mess.
Yeah.
And just,
can't
like,
do much.
Like, sleepwalking through
like,
the day.
Like, don't fuck with me right now.
Yeah.
Like,
at night is when she's totally crazy.
That makes sense.
Yeah. So going off of her, then we have Pierre Michel, who is the conductor of the Orient Express, played by Marwan Kanzari, who I think is the guy who's playing Jafar in the Aladdin.
He is, yes.
He's really attractive.
Oh, I think he's fucking gorgeous.
Yeah.
Doesn't have much to do in this movie, though.
He's the brother of the maid charged with the kidnapping who committed suicide.
It's the weakest connection of them all.
I think he has the least connection to the family, but I think he certainly has a connection to the case because his sister did kill herself.
True.
So, like, if it was just that, like, my sister was very upset that she was falsely convicted of a crime, but then she went home and got over it, I'd be like, okay, like, reel it in. But, I mean, his sister died. So, getting to what Chris wanted to get to, Carolyn Hubbard, played by Michelle Pfeiffer, she is a flirty and over-the-top widow.
Wait, we talk about Willem Dafoe?
No, we didn't, because that's why there's still a few left. She is actually Linda Goldenberg, stage name Linda Arden, the actress and grandmother of Daisy Armstrong. Chris, you had something to say about her, I think.
Well, I just mean, I think Michelle Pfeiffer turns in a fucking awesome performance.
She's
never off. She always knows the tenor of the scene. I think in moments I was turning to both of you and saying, like, Linda Arden, the character, is doing amazing acting work, and therefore Michelle Pfeiffer is doing amazing acting work playing an actress playing this character. You see those layers with Michelle Pfeiffer, and as ever, this is Michelle Pfeiffer's second appearance in a movie we've done. She's fucking amazing.
What was the first one?
Dark Shadows.
Yeah, no, I agree with you for the most part. She's one of the only real sources of levity for a lot of this movie in the beginning before you find out like her actual tragic story. But like, she's the one who's actually providing jokes for a movie that doesn't have a lot of fun and levity in it.
She is my source of ridiculous woman in a ridiculous dress in this movie.
Yeah.
She's over the top. She's kooky. I love her line where she says to him, "I know you think I'm a ridiculous woman." Does she say, "Silly woman"?
Yeah.
"Silly woman," she says.
Yeah, and the scene that she has with Johnny Depp really briefly where, like, they meet in a hallway before he is stabbed and they just have, like, a quick exchange where he clearly doesn't know who she is and, like, flirts with her a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
And she just has that, like, little scene with him where it seems like she's just kind of being dismissive of his flirting, but you know later on, rewatching it, that, like, she's confronting the guy who killed her granddaughter and basically, like, destroyed her entire family.
Yeah.
So, it's a very well-acted scene on Michelle Pfeiffer's part.
Yeah.
Next is Princess Natalia Dragomirov, played by Judi Dench. She is a Russian princess, the close friend of Linda Goldenberg, and godmother to Sonia Goldenberg.
I mean, you guys have talked so much about Olivia Colman showing up for only 5 minutes, but, like, why are we not talking about...
I feel like I'm used to Judi Dench doing this.
I guess, that's my thing. Like, this is a Judi Dench role. This movie is the kind of venue for actors to show up and do not much.
Yeah.
A couple minutes.
My point with Olivia Colman is that she, like...
She's
like,
more fresh, I get it.
Well, no, it's not even that. It's also just sort of like, I don't get anything from her in these scenes. Like, she's not distinctive to me.
Whereas
Judi Dench here, right?
I mean, I guess just that she's Judi Dench. Like, she has the presence of being Judi Dench.
I think you, as an audience, you can't separate Judi Dench from the character.
It's true.
You're seeing the nobility of Judi Dench.
Yes, well, and you're also watching Judi Dench do an accent, which is not something I feel like I've had a lot of in my life.
She does accent work all the time because I'm American.
Oh, God. Okay.
So they're doing 24/7 accent work over there, I can tell you.
And let me tell you, it's great. But the Olivia Colman of it all, to me, was just that...
Well, sorry, real quick then. Hildegard Schmidt, played by Olivia Colman, she was the lady's maid to Princess Dragomirov. She was actually the cook for the Armstrong house.
It's also like a tier 4 connection.
No, again, like lowest level connection.
Yeah.
For me, the Olivia Colman of it all is, I am normally so zeroed in on what she's doing as an actress, and basically anything. Even, like, I was saying before we were watching this, like... I would look forward to her appearances on Peep Show. So, like, now it's just sort of like, Olivia Colman, I know you could have done more than this role. And that's why it stands out to me.
She needed to. It was just like, she got a paycheck. She clearly wanted to do this.
I think it's mostly
for me. The character didn't call for much.
See, I think that it's you don't get as much time with her, and she doesn't get, like, her character doesn't have, like, an interesting moment really so much, because her character exists mostly to, like, back up what Judi Dench is saying.
The only metatextual interesting moment you get is, oh my God, can Olivia Colman speak German?
It's like her and the Cuban American guy.
Yeah.
Sort of like,
for sure.
You get, like, very little of them, because at some point, you just need bodies to fill seats.
Yeah, true. Lastly, we have Gerard Herman, played by Willem Dafoe, a German professor. In actuality, is Cyrus Hardman, a Pinkerton detective hired by Ratchet. But before that, he was a police officer who was in love with the maid who killed herself.
Yeah.
It almost feels like three characters dumped into one, but Willem Dafoe looks like a stone-cold silver fox in this movie.
I'd watch a whole movie about his character, honestly. I feel like he's got his own movie to sell.
I mean, it's just because you kept peeling away layer after layer with, like, what his character was, where it's like, no, not only, like, first of all, like, oh, I'm a professor. No, I'm not. I'm actually, like, a Pinkerton detective. No, I'm not. I'm a police officer who's now a Pinkerton detective.
By the way,
who's pretending to be a German.
The fact that all happened in one scene was unconscionable.
And he's clearly got, like, big backstory going on
big.
Here. Like,
honestly, he kind of has the biggest backstory of them all.
Yeah.
Just
like,
in terms of the,
like,
turns it takes.
It feels like it could have been his movie altogether.
Yeah.
Sometimes. Like.
Ooh. That's an interesting fix, by the way.
Well, maybe I'll stay tuned.
But, I mean, on a very shallow level, Willem Dafoe looked great in that
No, he did. I have found him to be much more attractive as an older man than in his prime.
He also, like, Willem Dafoe nailed the accent work. In between the kind of New York Pinkerton detective sound, but also the German accent was great.
He said Toin instead of Toin, which is how I knew he was not a real German.
All right, thank you so much, Kenneth.
My mustache is, she's ridiculous.
Do we have anyone else to
Yes,
approach?
We do. We have the victim, Jonald Depp.
Jonald Depp.
Who plays Edward Ratchet, a.k.a. Cassetti. He is a mafia member who was responsible, obviously, for the death of baby Daisy Armstrong, later escaped to Europe and changed his name, and he's the one who done got stabbed 12 times.
I think we just have to give Braunock some kind of medal for reining in Johnny Depp.
So do you want to add this to God?
Completely!
Whenever I was watching this again, and I was talking to Rich about it, I said something about how, and obviously, Johnny Depp was fine in this movie, and we were like, but when was the last time we saw him in a movie? We were trying to think, and we were like, oh, he was in fucking Harry Potter, like, the most recent Harry Potter. It's like, that's how little of an impact he's making at this point, where, like, I forget that he's even in these fucking movies, because it's just like he's just like playing such like a shtick to the point that, like, I can't even respond to it anymore. Like, you just get used to it. Like, you're inoculated.
I think we're desensitized to the Johnny Depp shtick.
Right.
Which is why it's so refreshing to see him not do that here.
Right, no, he's doing a really bizarre American accent, to be fair. Like, it's a very sort of, I'm a mobster. I may not be from a distinct place in America, but I got a lot of accents creeping in.
But it meets the theatrical height of this movie's tone in general, I feel, where it doesn't stick out as much as you expect, or kind of brace yourself for Johnny Depp to be too weird for the movie he's in.
Yeah, I think they were also very wise in killing Johnny Depp off in the first 40 minutes.
I mean, what a great choice for a movie.
As in, like, we were watching this, like, the time I just should have been like, come see 12 people stab Johnny Depp.
12 prominent members.
Hollywood finally strikes back.
Hollywood assembles with their knives to kill Johnny Depp. That was satisfying, we can't deny.
It was. I mean, so if you're going to put Johnny Depp in your movie, I don't know, maybe kill him off after, like, the first act or something. As we went through them all, we had 13 total suspects, but it's really kind of 12 because the book kind of counts the Count and Countess as one person.
Yeah.
Like, they're sort of one functioning unit.
They really are kind of like...
they're barely separated.
They are sort of like ego, super ego, and id in a pair.
And so, like, it's possible that in the book it says that, like, the Countess doesn't actually stab Ratchet. Like, she's, like, not physically capable of doing it, so her husband does it.
So she's so drugged out, she
sends
her
husband
in? Yeah,
that she just can't... No, that, like, they're both there, but she just can't do it. And the other thing is that in the 70s, movie, she is going to, like, pick up the knife, and as she does it, her husband puts his hands over hers, and then they, like, both do it because he thinks that she's, like, gonna stop.
So, in symbolically, it's both of them.
Right, yeah. So it's an odd choice to make, as opposed to just, like, why not have a chauffeur show up in your movie with a tangential relationship?
Yeah!
That's Agatha Christie for you, I suppose.
Does the cook really need to do this? Like...
Yeah.
Oh, that was one less mouth eating my souffle.
So... having covered all of the victims, let's just talk a little bit about the mystery itself and the conclusion of the mystery.
As this movie, this adaptation specifically parcels it out, it's a lot of telling the story of the Armstrongs. It's not a lot of the mystery itself.
So here's the point that I have real quick is that, yes, this movie is weirdly preoccupied by the Armstrong thing, but only after about 50 minutes or so have passed before it mentions them whatsoever, which I think is a weird mistake to bring up. Like, the crux of your mystery comes into play so late in this movie that I think it affects how you view the ending, because at a certain point, it doesn't feel like it's a given that these people are somehow related, where if you had revealed this early on, you would not have to deal with. But at a certain point, it's like, why, she's related too, and so is he. This is surprising. How are all these people related? Like, the movie plays it off as more of like a confusing thing that it's trying to work out, whereas it could just be kind of thrown away pretty early on.
Yeah. I think I can sum this up pretty efficiently.
Yeah.
I don't think we need to spend a whole lot of time on this. I think it's pretty obvious what has happened here, even as someone who has not read the book.
Right.
I think that this is just a good mystery told badly.
Mm-hmm.
The mystery has good bones, and Brendan, you referenced the 70s version of this movie that already is able to drop these clues in a much clearer way throughout, and this... get this thread going with the Armstrong connection more naturally throughout the movie. So I think that the gradual revealing of clues is there. Like, Agatha Christie knew what she was doing right. when she, like, did this, and it follows mm-hmm. the proper rules of mystery writing.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of it just got lost in this adaptation.
There's a lot of, like, red herrings that are introduced in, like in a lot of, like, deduction work done by Poirot that I told you guys about, where, like, he realizes that someone's lying because they're using word association, or he realized that someone said a thing that an American would have said, not a British person.
I would have killed for that in this, because as it stands, the middle portion is so interminable and not interesting, because all we get is he... I don't have a problem with the structure of, like, and now I'm going to talk to this suspect. That's fine. But you were saying that in the 70s version, which I vaguely recollect, he was catching them in small lies.
Right.
And that small lies thing keeps the mystery alive of, like, oh, is it this person now? Oh, is it this person?
Right.
That's fun.
A problem, sorry, just the problem that I have with this one is that it's very difficult for me to understand how one, like, clue has connected to the previous thing for Poirot. Like,
yeah.
I can't follow his logic at all in this. It was surprising to me when he deduces that Ratchet is Cassetti, because I don't quite know how he got to that point. And then he just does a lot of interviewing with people where he, like, recognizes something and makes a note of something, but then later on it feels like there's a connection there that I'm not quite getting.
In terms of whether or not this is a mystery that the viewers can follow along with actively, like, and can solve along with a detective, or one where it is a full reveal, it's definitely the latter in this case,
yeah.
because this movie does yeah. not let you into the process of
it's,
realizing
it's
what's going
on. It's weird, though, because, like Lee said, I'm sure the source material itself is a lot easier to, like, track one step to the other. It's just so odd that this one kind
yeah.
of doesn't feel the need to commit to that.
And what a choice to make in your adaptation. It's a mystery, but we're going to cut out a lot of the stuff that leads us
right,
to the
and we'll
answer.
Right, and we'll be throwing in some new clues that weren't in the books, and, like, you know, let's
reason?
See how that is.
Well, and also, like, you know what was missing? Action scenes. Go ahead, I'm sorry.
Sorry, it's the difference between ending a scene where you have a... It's interminable because you see, you perceive this, like, endless amount of, like, interview.
Mm-hmm, right.
And in the movie that we see, it's sort of an inconclusive, like... Some stuff that doesn't quite add up. Okay.
Yeah.
Move on
yeah.
to the next one.
yeah.
Stuff that doesn't quite add up. Okay. Whereas in, if you were to say, like, the 70s version, which again, I have not seen, but, like, it's the difference between that, watching what we saw, and watching
right.
a movie where, like, there's an interview and it ends with, but you were lying about that.
Right. Yeah. But I just realized something that, like,
yes.
you said,
and
perhaps
then
you don't quite realize it.
Thing.
Yeah.
And so, like, even if there's ways to do these scenes where there's a suspense building up because you're seeing as he goes along, like, he's realizing these
right,
things.
Right, because you, the viewer, are also realizing that,
yeah.
like, what they're saying doesn't jive with what the previous person
yeah,
said.
Yeah, and so there's a building of a narrative from that perspective versus in this movie, you're just along for this, like, well, okay.
Yeah, this series of, like, quasi-unrelated interviews.
Yeah.
Like, we're just, questions are asked, things are said, but we don't quite understand why it connects or matters.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So the ending itself of this, the solution to the mystery, obviously, as we had said previously, the solution is that they all did it. All of them took turns stabbing Cassetti / Ratchet so that no one would really have to know who was the one who actually killed him.
I don't hate that as a development in and of itself. It's just the way that it's done in this movie, I kind of roll my eyes at. Particularly visually, the way it's executed is they're lined up Last Supper style at a
yeah.
long table that Poirot, it's outside at the opening of a tunnel that
right.
the train was going to head into,
right.
that Poirot approaches very dramatically to, like, present his theory, and it felt indulgent in a not fun way.
I'm into some of it. I'm a fair deal of it, frankly.
Here's how I would have redone it. Not that anyone's asking, but I would have had it in a train car. I would have had him in the center of a ring of them around him. And that
I think
way...
it's just the fact that it's a wide table is the thing that's sort
yeah.
of a little like, okay,
I mean,
we get it.
At some point, like, if any wide table evokes the Last Supper...
Yeah.
I mean, it does. Like,
but it was also like, it is a long table with everyone. It's
I
hard
guess.
To not, it's hard to not see that.
But
yeah.
I mean, I didn't really perceive, I didn't get, I could, you guys were joking about it the second it happened. So, like, I did see it a little bit, but, like, at the same time, like, it's, there was sort of like a decent enough narrative reason for why they were out there, which is that they had to get everyone off the train to, like,
right.
pump it back
yeah.
on the tracks.
Sure.
And of course they're going to go in the tunnel where it's not snowing
mm-hmm.
and where there's at least some wind shelter.
I see all of that, but it's still a choice in terms of shooting it.
Yeah,
I
think
was
it's
sort
a
of,
good
I was,
choice.
I don't know. I would have pulled back.
I honestly think I would have been better off if it had been in the car.
Me too.
Like the train car.
I like it. I think it's good to put the dramatic scenes outside especially because like people are uncomfortable.
Mm.
And I think I like the idea that like it's not the comfort of the train during this, like, high-tension reveal scene. But I don't think that there's anything inherently bad. I think that there's opinions about it being bad, but I don't think there's anything inherently bad about choosing to put it outside. I think it's more, there's different things about the solution that are problematic. which is the fact that it seemingly comes out of nowhere.
Right, there is that issue, where in the movie it kind of feels like Poirot just sort of, like, throws it out, like, well, I can't justifiably prove that any one of you did it, so, guess you all did. Like, whereas, in, like, the 70s version, it's more of a lead-up, where he's, like, going through each person by person and being like, and this is where you lied to me, and this is where you lied to me, like, so I've caught you all in all these various fibs and everything like that, where here it's just sort of like, you've all been bad, so I guess it was all you guys.
Yeah.
Also, it's a little ambitious to get together 12 people to try and kill one person, especially when, as we've established, these people have varying levels of relation to the actual central cause of this, where some people are like, well, it was your daughter who died, or it was your sister died also. And then at a certain point, it's like, well, you were the maid at the house, and you lost your job afterwards, so you're probably mad.
I would sort of be willing to let it go if the movie did not attempt to portray them each as having an equal stake in killing Johnny Depp, which they do. And because the whole, I actually like how that shot, the scene of them tripping into his room and each taking turns stabbing him, I think that's actually pretty cool. But in terms of, like, does really each character have an equal stake in seeing him dead?
No, certainly not.
Absolutely not.
Again, I think that this is problematic. I think this is part of the, I'm not going to say that, like, Agatha Christie fucked up writing, but, like, at the time, this Lindbergh thing was fairly fresh.
Right.
And maybe there wasn't as much posterity about the overall kind of person that Lindbergh was, as we talked about, and like how it fit in with the rest of his life.
In retrospect, Lindbergh of it all does not hold up as something great.
And sidebar, I really hate when people do like X of it all. I hate that. I hate that phrasing. But yeah, I think that Christie probably, as a mystery writer, was like fascinated by this thing that in real life that had happened, much like a Law and Order writer of today writes about Gamergate.
Imagine the Christie today writing like a Gamergate.
but for Law and Order, which they did. Like that
Agatha Christie is what I said.
That was wild shit.
Yeah. Agatha Christie wrote for Law and Order?
No, I just mean if there was an Agatha Christie of today, she'd be tempted to write that Law and Order Gamergate episode.
They showed for SVU. But no, like it makes sense why she would have latched onto this as like a mystery to write. But I think that she had a good instinct for the solution, but I don't think the crime matches up for that.
Yeah.
Because again, it's a very, I'm not going to trivialize kidnapping and murder, but I think it's a fairly trivial crime for 12 different, very different people to be that.
I mean, for me, it's like the housing staff probably doesn't care, right? Like, I'm sure they thought the kid was a great kid and they could be very sad that she died. But nonetheless, like if I had done this job 5 years ago, then you called me up on the phone like, hey, you want to kill that guy who killed my daughter? I'd be like, well, probably not.
I guess the only way around it that I could see this working is if they emphasized, like, the cook, the chauffeur, they felt personally connected to Michelle Pfeiffer. Well, and that when she said, let's do this, they're like, okay, this is a favor to you. I'm not personally affected by your tragedy, but I care about you, so well, yes.
See, and the weird thing is, I think they do a decent job of bringing in, like, people with non-existent relationships to Daisy in the first place. Like, Josh Gad's character is there because his father was part of, like, the prosecution who charged this maid in this crime who then, like, later killed herself because she was innocent. Mm-hmm. And so his father was sort of, like, shunned out of a job at that point. And, like, honestly, like, that's a pretty good reason for wanting revenge on the guy who, like, you know, ended up, like, causing your father to go to ruin.
I think he's tier two in terms of connections. I believe there's four tiers of connections here. And we have
number one with a bullet.
Well, number one with a bullet, we have Pfeiffer and we have the sister, right? They're kind of tier one.
Blood
direct relatives that have both been affected. I mean, Pfeiffer's in control of her life to some extent, but her child is dead and her grandchild is dead.
Yeah. And
the sister is just fucked up.
But you can buy both of them wanting to get good on their
side. Although you do have to feel bad for, like, Barbital Sis when she's sitting there in the cave and Michelle Pfeiffer's like, I'll just kill myself. I have nothing left to live for anyway. Your sister's like,
I know.
Like, sorry, Mom.
I think I said that immediately. I was like, you have another daughter. And she's right there.
No, like, thank God she's strung out on laudanum right now.
I feel like Josh Gad is maybe not tier two. Because tier two is still pretty personal.
So tier two would be like Denshi.
Yeah.
We have Denshi, we have Daisy Ridley.
And I would say the Count.
Daisy Ridley as well.
Yeah, the Conductor. Like people who are directly not related. Like, again, the Conductor probably has a pretty... The Conductor might frankly be tier one.
He might
because,
be
like,
tier
his
one.
Sister
Someone
did
died.
Die.
Someone died.
It's not just like he knew the baby who died.
You're right. For as little as the Conductor has to do with the story, he's tier one. Yeah. I think Penelope Cruz and Daisy Ridley are tier two because they're directly tied in with what was going on.
Yeah, right. They were there.
They were there.
They're the governess and the nurse, respectively. they both feel as if someone slipped past them when they right. should have kept them out.
I think Detective is tier two because he fell in love with the woman that killed herself.
That's yes. true, too.
And tier three is Josh Gad.
Arbuthnot?
Arbuthnot, yeah, he was just a doctor that knew the guy. Right. No one died.
Yeah.
He's definitely a tier three.
Or is he tier four? Because I feel like at tier four we have Schmidt.
The cook.
Yeah.
We have the chauffeur.
Right.
Where I'm just sort of
No, I think Cook and Chauffeur, yeah, maybe the Doctor or Tier 4. And yeah. Tier 3 is Josh Gad,
oh, but we have, father's life is ruined. Masterman, the butler. He'd be like 3 probably, right?
I think he's 3 because he had didn't he have the military connection?
He knew the family and he was their butler, but it's not like, you know, to our knowledge, it's Ratchet shot.
Actually,
it's
the Doctor and Butler are Tier 3 bordering on 4.
Yeah.
I agree.
So as you can see, there are a lot of different reasons, or like there's a different increments reasons in terms of why you would want to kill this person. Like it just, again, if you have 12 people involved in this, like, what happens if one says no? Then, like, they're like, okay, like no, and also, I think I should call the police and tell them that you're planning this, like, mass murder.
All right, and I have 2 points to make.
Well, it's a different definition of mass murder.
No. I mean, one person, but a mass of murderers.
Is it mass murder, or is it the mass murdering?
Yeah. It's everyone kills one person.
Yeah.
It's a mass to one.
Yeah.
Okay, so 2 things. One, you may think we're all psychopaths for needing to, like, find tiers of connection, but I think that's actually important for a story like this, honestly, is for someone to buy it. But I would also put out there, like, it strains credulity when you're telling me, like, the chauffeur and the cook are both so connected to this woman. They felt the need to kill the person that kidnapped the child of the family. And I'm like, maybe, but it's a little much.
Right. And the only reasoning I can really find for this amount of people in terms of the story itself is that in the book, I believe there is a line that Arbuthnot has about how he respects trial by jury because it's like 12 peers passing judgment.
By the way, I was paying attention, not in this movie.
Okay, yeah, which is really weird because that is a clue that like tips Poirot off into realizing, oh, 12 people on here, 12 people in a jury, you all did it. And so it's the trial by jury thing is just like a nice little give that he has that both like explain to Poirot like what the deal is with the plot going on. It's just odd. Like you said, that the movie itself doesn't seem to, like, bring that point back in.
It's a meta nod that I think I could have used.
Yeah, because, and again, like that is the reason why you want to have 12 people doing this. Like, it's symbolic of that. Well, but it doesn't really come up in the movie. And also, like, again, as I said, 12 is a lot of people to bring in. You could easily cut out, like, 2 or 3 of those people.
Yeah.
Keep it a smaller crowd. You don't need it to be 12, except that the story wants to make that reference.
I think it's a juicy detail that Christia wanted to put in there.
Yeah, no, like, I agree. And I think it says interesting things about, like, his character and, like, her character's way, Michelle Pfeiffer's character.
I think you could easily have had 12 people, but not all of them actually stabby-stab.
Well, and
like, right, some of them are just helping.
It's sort of an interesting literal interpretation, though, isn't it? Of, like, technically, the 12 members of a jury would be, in some way, if you think about it, responsible for Johnny Depp's death. But in this case, they are literally physically responsible for his death. Because they found him guilty. I actually think if we did get that line from literally anyone in this movie, that would have made swallowing this 4 tiers of people involved a little easier. Because then I would have seen this theme of the movie a little more explicitly. As is, it feels like we're starting to pop the bubble of that this movie otherwise successfully maintains a little bit when we're like, actually, it's 12 people,
right,
and they're all equally in stake in this.
And when you throw it, as you said, when you throw it in that far at the end also, it makes that more of the focus of the twist.
Yes.
Where, like, it comes at a point where it sounds so improbable to have just realized that it made me just be like, wait, like how is this at all physically possible?
Which, by the way, this is another reflection on, I feel, how, like, the middle part of this movie just sort of loses you. We were actively discussing during the movie how much better this would have been had they planted the idea that they're all connected in some way very early in the movie, and then the reveal is, oh, it's the Armstrong thing and it's this.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas because that all comes in kind of close to the third act, you're sort of like, whoa, 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 whoa. Like, that's a lot to happen at once. It almost feels Deus Ex Machina level.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. There is an opening sequence that was added for this version of the movie that does not exist in the book or any previous adaptation. We open, as you had said earlier, Chris, in Jerusalem, I believe it is, where there is basically like a holy war starting to break out because a object of importance was stolen. A holy site. And there is a rabbi, a priest, and an imam there who are like all theoretically, you know, who are all potential suspects in this case.
I don't remember what the relic is. I think the movie also forgets.
Well, but no, I mean, it's a MacGuffin. It doesn't matter.
It's like an Abrahamic relic that is important to both Muslims,
it's
Jewish people, and Christians.
It's the thing they care about.
I don't like that as a lead into this character.
So I don't mind it opening with a mystery to let you get to know Poirot.
Fine with that. The nature of the mystery is what bugs me.
I don't think the nature of the mystery is the problem. I think the issues that you have may be more with the execution of it.
There is, because part of this, after Poirot establishes to the crowd that it was the police chief who had done this, prior to saying this, he jabs his cane in the side of a wall.
For no apparent reason.
At the time. We later find out that he puts it in the wall because he, I guess, knew that the chief of police would run down the side of the wall, not see the cane in front of him, whack himself in the head, and fall over.
It's debatable whether or not he, like, knew it, or it was, like, a fortuitous thing, but why'd he put it in the wall?
If he had just, like, stuck it in, like, the dirt or something, just as a way of getting it out of the way, and then just, you know, the guy happens to hit his knee on it and falls over when he's running away, that's fine. The fact that he shoves it into a wall for no reason in the script for him to do this is what sort of just makes it hard to swallow.
I think it's a good... the concept of opening on a little short mystery is good, but I think you tread on dangerous territory when you have to append your own mystery writing to Agatha Christie.
Yeah, there is that, right? So there's also, to be fair, like, it's bizarre to me that the chief of police would have called in Poirot to solve this case for him, because he's calling in someone who is, like, the self-proclaimed best detective of the world with 100% track record. He's like, but surely I, a chief of police in some shit town, will be able to pull the wool over the eyes of Hercule Poirot. It's like, how did he view this going?
I know. Well, it really does beggar belief, because maybe I'm giving you too much credit, but maybe it's supposed to be like he was so confident that he had, like, evaded possible connection to this
thing.
That he was like, oh, I could call him the greatest detective and he wouldn't even see
it. No, it's just the movie forgot.
Yeah.
The movie forgets a couple things. It forgets that, and it forgets that at the beginning of the movie, the whole reason he's getting on the Orient Express is because, like, someone calls him to England to solve a crime.
Right, yeah.
And at the end of the Orient Express, he's not even near England. He's, like, halfway to England.
Right.
When somebody tells him, like, now you gotta go to Egypt. What happened to England? We'll never know.
Which, by the way, does make you feel bad for that character, because he mentions several times throughout the movie, I'm tired and I want my rest.
Yeah. Just being dragged from Jerusalem to the UK, back to Egypt.
From Jerusalem to the UK to a train headed through Czechoslovakia.
But that was on the way to the UK.
Yeah.
And I'm saying, like, yeah, he's, like, literally on forms of travel.
Yeah.
Can't get a break. Of course he wants a vacation.
Get a break.
Stop calling him to different parts, corners of the world to solve mysteries. Let the man rest.
There's also a little bit in the beginning where we establish that Hercule Poirot is a bit of an anal retentive character, where he wants two eggs of the exact same size and shape. And so what he does to get this is we open with a tiny brown child running through the streets of this town, bringing back eggs to Hercule Poirot, who will look at them, decide that they are not of equal size, and then the kid will get sent back to find more eggs to bring to Poirot. Then at the end of the scene, Poirot doesn't eat them. He gives them to the kid, to be fair, but you can also imagine a version of the scene where the kid is just shoved out of the hotel, right? Be like, all right, you little shit, back on the streets with you.
I don't like this.
Love the optics of the scene,
nope.
First of all, where you have, for the whims of this middle-aged white guy, like, this tiny child is being forced to run tiny brown child is being forced to run all over this fucking town
to try
and find two eggs of matching size and shape. And, like, Lee, you had said...
There's some degree of, like, us being three white people looking for things to call out that are not necessarily our fight, because, if this movie sort of did in France and it was just a French waiter who was forced to return eggs multiple times, it would be the same exact scene with the same level of whimsy to it, and we would not be questioning it.
There are layers to this that just...
It's just pure optics.
It's also, also, I think, the fact that he's a child, too. Even if it were, like an older, like, Middle Eastern man, I'd probably be like, okay, like, this is fine. This
is
your job.
Chill wouldn't be great. I think it's a combination. I think it's the youth, and I think it's the race thing.
I also feel like there's a fine line between being charming with that kind of thing and being, like, an oppressive jackass, you know?
True.
Like,
it's
one thing to be, like, finicky.
I think it's just the choice to do it, this scene and this, you could put the scene elsewhere with different people and it would not be questionable at all.
Yeah, I feel like also if he had cut it out earlier, maybe, like, if he had, like, just looked at the eggs and be like, oh, like, they're not a perfect Schlesinger someday. Like, it's okay.
Yeah.
We'll get it. These will be fine. Don't worry about it. But it's just the fact that he keeps making him do it so many times. So, last lastly, we'll just cover the look of the movie, including the actual cinematography itself. This is a very comforting-looking movie. There is something just very pleasing mm-hmm. to me about being in this nice, cozy, expensive train in the middle of nowhere with snow going on the outside, and, like, you just have to sit inside and drink hot chocolate all day. So this is, like, thematic porn, you know, in that sense. Like, it's inspired to this thing, like, you simply cannot do. Like, we don't have trains that do this anymore. And, like, this is just not a thing that you can indulge in now. So, like, watch this and feel fucking bad about how you're on Amtrak.
to zoom out from that just a scotch, there's also just, as a viewer, something comforting about watching this, like, prestige piece with so many recognizable faces that you know and love perform these characters. Is it amazing? No. But it's almost beside the point. Like, I'm not going to tell anyone that this movie is high quality, but there is something, like, comforting and just nice and pleasant about this.
It's high quality. It's not a great movie, but I think it's high quality.
Yes.
Yeah.
It looks great.
You cannot deny the acting is great, and it's visually great.
CGI is not so great.
The CGI is not great, but I think it looks fun.
Yeah, well...
It's fun.
Well, what did we say when we have fun.
It's fun.
We do have fun.
No, I would say it looks like a good video game.
Exactly.
It's not real.
But we were saying that at the beginning, and I still stand by this.
It's all made to romanticize these, like
locales.
Oh my god, these mountains are so beautiful.
Yeah.
And Istanbul is so beautiful.
Yeah.
Look at the sunset.
The largest mountains anywhere.
It's supposed to, that's sort of where we edge into the fantastical, and I'm actually okay with that.
I think we talked about, amongst each other, that there's some good cinematography, but then sometimes it starts to lose its power.
Right.
Because it's overused. But I think for having to shoot a film mostly on a train, there's some cool overheady shots that maybe a little overused. There's like shots through windows that are less cool.
Mm-hmm.
But there are also decisions to like setting shots of like, we're going to have this conversation on the cargo hold. We're going to open the door to see like the mountains.
The sweeping vistas.
Yeah, which I'm fine. I'm finally fine with because like the meat of the scene is still the same. It's just like, again, I think some of this was Brunog being like, shit, it's a modern audience. They're not going to watch this parlor mystery.
Yeah.
We got to find something to do here.
Throw in some action scenes.
Yeah.
So I agree with you in the sense that I understand the desire to open some of that up. I don't think it works for me. I kind of think it loses the general claustrophobic feel of these people trapped together over the span of a few train cars, basically. So, like, it is a very claustrophobic mystery just by dint of the fact that, like, these people generally can't leave this train, whether it's because of a snowdrift or because they're dangling over an abyss. And they're all trapped inside there, so they, you know, while this whole investigation is going on, you have to deal with the anxiety of that versus just the fact that you are people stuck in a train together. So, like, there is a certain feel that I think this movie doesn't really have because it is so willing to go out into the snowbanks or chase Josh Gad off some scaffolding.
It feels like it lets some of the steam out, whereas I would be interested to know what it would feel like if we had kept things contained. And just to kind of circle back very briefly, you kind of mentioned the shots through the window. There are two different kinds I was noticing. The one I liked was when it was just sort of a basic shot through the window.
Well, from outside the train.
Right, and you could see some of the landscape kind of on the window pane over their face. I thought that was sort of interesting. Where I began to roll my eyes was where it was like...
Through the bevel.
The beveled edge of the window and, ooh, everyone has two faces. Do you get it yet? I was like, enough. We went through that with Scandal. I don't want it in this.
That is something that Kenneth Branagh does indulge in quite a bit, I think, throughout this movie. He also, I think, kind of overuses the...
Aerial shot?
Yeah, the overhead shots that work to great effect early on, but then start to get a little like, okay, I understand that, like, you can do this with a camera.
Is everyone's favorite shot the one after the train is derailed where his head pokes out the bottom?
Yeah, like a cartoon character.
Are we dead? Yes, we dead?
Harry said, did we die?
Did we die? That's what he asked.
Did we die?
I love that. I need a gif of it. Did you have anything you wanted to talk about musically?
The score, I think, is not a bad score. It's Patrick Doyle, who's done a lot of Kenneth Branagh's movies. But the one thing that I think the movie does poorly is use the score. So there are scenes where there's a very sort of somber, dramatic piece of music that the movie uses a lot toward the end. There are scenes throughout the end of the movie that uses underscoring. Like, it uses it when it shows all of the murderers in the Armstrong household watching home footage of little baby Daisy and being like, see, that's why we're doing it.
That was fucking wild, by the way.
Yeah. And then it gets continued to use throughout the sequence. So you hear it again whenever Ratchet is getting stabbed. You hear it again whenever Michelle Pfeiffer picks up the gun and is about to shoot herself. It doesn't quite work in the scene where Ratchet is being stabbed, I think. Like, it's a little...
Oh, yeah. You mean with the tender...
Yeah, it's like...
With the tender emotional catharsis music?
Yeah.
The like... Meh, 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 of the violins as they're stabbing someone.
Yeah, it didn't quite work for me in that sequence. I would have been fine with no music,
and,
honestly.
Oh, I would too. I actually think that would have underscored the scene the best.
Yeah. I don't have much else to say apart from that, honestly, about the score itself. Yeah, since we've gotten to this point, I guess, do you guys want to start talking about fixes?
Sure. Mine is probably the shortest fix.
Go ahead.
I would love for the story to be told from the 12 suspects' perspective. I actually think there's a fun, almost farcical level kind of comedy you could tell with it, where I would love to see their reactions when they realize what the greatest detective on planet Earth is on the same train that they plan to kill Johnny Depp on. That would be fucking hysterical to see them scramble and be like, oh, fuck, we're done.
Right.
I would love to see who is the Doubting Thomas in that situation. I would love to see who in that group was like, no, we have to sally forth on this one. I think that would be really interesting, especially for the timing that you see in the events of this movie, where, like, Hercule is, like, inches away from, seconds away from getting a character to say something super revelatory, and then suddenly there's, like, a scream from off screen. I would love to see the lead up to that of, like, fuck, he's alone with Josh Gad. We need to disrupt this in some way. Ugh, stab me in the back! That would have been wild. And I think that would be a really fun way to sort of invert the mood of the movie. I think you even said it while we were watching it. Let's make it as if Noises Off was about a murder. That would be so much fun. And I actually think you could keep the same cast and get some pretty high-level comedy.
All those ag hags out there are not going to be happy with that change, Chris.
Fuck them. They're going to die soon. Ugh. Anyway.
Oh, your great aunts are not going to love your
Yeah.
Lee, would you like to go?
Sure. I think the egg hags are not going to be happy with me either, but because I have nothing to hold sacred about Poro.
Oh, Lee.
Nothing sacred?
What?
At long last, have you no dignity?
Yep. I just have, you know, I hold nothing sacred about Poro, and so I fully endorse doing a very off-brand take of Poro, and so I want to beef up what Branagh was offering with this movie. Where, I think the biggest problem that I have that we've discussed with the crime is the fact that it just doesn't seem worthy enough for 12 people to be that upset about that they want to kill this guy. So I would modify it so that if this is like the early 30s, maybe even I push it to the 20s a little bit, I'd want to have this be like a post-World War I thing. And have the crime be some sort of World War I era sort of war crime.
Oh, interesting.
And maybe Ratchet is like some sort of like profiteer from the war. And through his actions, he fucked up many lives. Maybe there was one big thing within a village. Like, I think centering it on like a village in particular is a good thing. Because like you could branch that out. Like the people could have scattered and formed new lives. And the connection back to this village would be much harder and less like obtuse, but could still be equally as powerful. Like, this whole village got fucked up, so, like, it's not like two people died and we're all broken up about these two individual people, but it's like, well, it's my grandmother and your uncle, and, like, my child died through the actions of this guy who, like, I don't know, sold information about a spy here and the enemy, like, fucked up a whole town for it. I think that I would want to also further that and connect Branagh's lost love thing to, like, during the war, he has this sort of, like, sort of detective fellow that he was, and sort of, like, his sort of Epicurean hates imbalance, and it's kind of like a little, what's the word I'm looking for? Like, particular, but to a point, like, anal-retentiveness, like, was not, like, even though he would have been of, like, fighting age, was, like, found a way to get out of it and try to, like, avoid having to go into war, because it was just not going to be seen. But his lost love was, like, bullshit about that and went off to, like, be a nurse. And maybe she died in that same village or is sort of related to this guy as well. And perhaps there's a connection to why he ends up on that train. So it's not, like, an accident that he's on that train. That, like, there's a... Maybe the mastermind of this whole thing also somehow roped him onto this train to be there. And I like I would go further with his position in this movie where I think at the end, in this movie, he's sort of like he's struggling with living a post-war life, even though he didn't live through it. Like, he lost a lot of people through it probably, and like doesn't and feels has a lot of guilt about the inaction during the war that he had. And like, he has solved a lot of crime, but he's seen a lot of shitty things anyway. And he's just sort of like tired of living and like is ready to give it all up because he just is like struggling to find his place in the world. And so I kind of like the idea that he's like ready to die. Essentially.
Oh,
and
that's
like,
fascinating.
Because that's the biggest thing I like about the end is that, like, I think that what Branagh is maybe... I don't know that he's trying to do this, but with the idea of him being so angsty and being offering up this thing that's not in the book where he's like, you're gonna have to kill me, I think that, like, you would only really do that if you were, like, looking for an easy way out.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you're not... It's, like, a sort of fun way to be, like... If
it makes
gun,
more
maybe
sense.
The gun wasn't not reloaded
yeah.
at all, and instead
yeah.
it was, like, he really was... Maybe the gun is loaded, and she doesn't try to kill herself with it, but no one picks up the gun.
Mm-hmm.
And it was just him trying to get him... Just to, like, get someone else to pull the trigger for
it's
him.
It's sort of death denied to the death seeker.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so I kind of like that, and that maybe the movie... The fact that, like, he has this connection as well... and that they all, he finds out the crime, and that they all did it, it helps him to sort of, like, find that level of, like, catharsis that he hasn't had in a while.
Mm.
That justice was truly done.
All right, so what I have for mine is a little more vague than I usually go with. A big issue that I had with this general tradition of the movie is the way that Poirot is portrayed in this movie. I think there is something to be said about making him a little more serious and a little, you know, having a little more gravitas than you might have find in the original movie or in the books. But I think this movie overdoes it just a little bit. I think perhaps the dead or lost love is a little too much for me, I think. I think that the way he describes his outlook where in the beginning when he's in Jerusalem where he steps into the camel shit or whatever it is.
Yeah.
And just says, like, it's you know, it's not the fact that I stepped in, it's the fact that now that there's an imbalance between my left shoe and my right shoe, so, and he sticks his right shoe into the
yeah.
shit also. And he also talks about how, like, he's only capable of seeing the world as it should be, like, not, you know, the imperfections. And I think that that's a fine, those are both, like, fine things to drive him as a character that need not be taken to such a dramatic point.
Mm-hmm.
As I said, I would definitely keep everything entirely inside the train because I think it loses the claustrophobia. I think also in the end, Lee, you and I had a similar conclusion where you said that, like, the real problem for you was just the mystery itself. Like, the particulars of the mystery itself in terms of, like, why these people were there and why they were stabbing him,
yeah.
like, worked for you. So in theory that, like, just changing, keeping the settings but changing up the mystery would go a long way toward making it work for you.
Yeah, mm-hmm. changing the inciting cause for
yes.
this murder.
Which is, I think, something that I had thought too. My initial thought was that maybe it was almost a Balto-type scenario. Like, this
he
small...
robbed a village of Peninsula.
Right, I think, like,
yeah.
this small town, like, was waiting on a shipment of something that would prevent, like, a bunch of their children from
yeah.
dying, and Ratchet, for whatever reason, like, you know, there was some mob issue, and he destroyed the van or whatever, but it never got to the town. So it's people that he, like, doesn't really know that he has a connection to, but
mm-hmm.
they all know that they have a connection to him, which I think is a little more interesting that he doesn't maybe realize, like, how many people he affected in his awful career.
Yeah.
I think it's also a stronger story for me because it feels sort of like a reverse It's a Wonderful Life, where it's like this one person's actions, like, destroyed an aspect of all of our lives. And so, like, this is what brings us together.
Mm-hmm.
Like, that we are...
And instead
know,
of becoming celebrated by the community, you're literally stabbed to death by
yeah.
the community.
And it's, right. So, well, that does happen in the director's cut of It's a Wonderful Life. Potter. All 12 of them go in there.
Oh my god, what an amazing crossover that would be.
All right, so now that we've all gone over this movie, would you recommend it?
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
I gotta be honest, are there things that could be a lot better to make it into, like, a legit good movie? Yeah, but it's a perfectly fun way to spend a winter afternoon.
Yeah, as we said, it looks great for the most part. It has really good actors in it. Even though I didn't care for the movie, and I, again, as I had said previously, I think that was just, like, the central trappings of the mystery that, like, messed it up for me, I would still go see the sequel to this as soon as it gets made.
I'm actually 100% interested in how they're going to approach Death on the Nile. There's always something that's going to be comforting to me about prestige mystery movies.
Yeah.
I don't know why, but it just
feels
good.
I'm glad
that,
like, someone is making this kind of movie.
Me too.
So,
mm-hmm.
yeah, sure, why not? Go see it.
Branagh is making Poirot someone I actually want to watch.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not really into the base level Poirot. I'm just not into the whole jolly Belgian bullshit.
But, I mean, we're all glad to see these people get paid to be on our screens and
mm-hmm.
give us
mm-hmm.
something.
All right, so I guess that's about it for this episode. As always, www.dratpack.com is a website that you can go to for some reason. You can download us on Stitcher or Apple Podcast, rate us on there, smash that subscribe button. We'll be back in 2 weeks with a mini episode, and until then, we will just buy it out.
Bye!
Bye. Au revoir!
Please, will you come?